They threw Valentine in a truck with a hood over his head, chained hand and foot, and nudged by what felt like a shotgun barrel every time he rolled too far away from the side of the bay. But he could still hear. They traveled at a good speed for what he guessed was a little over 2 hours. To occupy his mind, he counted minutes and scored them off into hours. Routine soaked up fear like a sponge. Then they parked, and quiet women's voices talked as the babies were passed out of the truck, soothing and cooing over the poor little things. He was the last to leave. They kept him blindfolded as someone, a woman by the smell of her, fed him, stripped him out of his uniform, and gave him a quick sponge bath. They let him use the toilet. Then they sat him in a room with a ticking fan, hands and legs cuffed to brackets in an electric chair-like frame. Valentine kept waiting for them to wire his genitals or fillings, but the silent workers left him alone. Finally, he heard someone enter.
Major Valentine?
Yes?
Do you know my voice?
Can't say that I do.
I'm Adler.
Now I see why I'm tied down.
Why is that?
So I don't go for your throat.
A 3 experienced bears with me.
Okay, I can't kill you. You gonna kill me?
Valentine wanted it out in the open, to know.
Me? No. Another? Quite likely. Unless... You see reason.
I can't see much in this mask.
I don't want you to identify this place to the Kurians. We're turning you over to them.
Valentine felt his pulse quicken.
What does seeing reason involve?
Forgetting all this ever happened? Rejoining Delta Group, I'll put you in a position where you can fight the good fight, as you see it. You'll hardly even know the action groups exist. You can fight the old-fashioned way, the useless way, wading into the enemy with banner unfurled. I have need of skilled officers who can keep the Kurian forces busy. You might be of use with the Big Mouths. They've been destructive as they've grown in familiarity with the waterways around Seattle.
Let me see your face.
Valentine sensed a mass shift behind him. The mask came off, and there was the real heart and soul and mind behind Pacific Command. Adler wore the patient face of a teacher, calm as a death mask, just old enough to be fatherly, just young enough for a spark. He had sad mortician's eyes, but there was a power behind them. Valentine felt the loom of the bears behind, though what he could accomplish shackled hand and foot. Maybe worst of all, Valentine liked him on sight.
What did Seattle do to you? You're laying waste to everything he owns.
I served him. On a whim. On a moment of appetite. He destroyed my children.
So now you're killing other people's children.
Oh, it's better than the alternative. A bullet ends the matter. Having your soul pulled apart, shred by shred, memory by memory. Every awful act laughed at, every joy mocked. No one deserves that.
I've always thought one's soul belonged to God.
Maybe. Nevertheless, the Kurians partake of the distilled experiences of a life, sip by sip. Stand with me, or I fear you'll find out.
How do you know so much about it?
He made me watch. He relished every detail, all because of a careless thought against him.
I am sorry.
Then you'll rejoin our war?
Your war.
For the first time, he looked exasperated.
Word games. Fine. My war.
I pound on the door while your murderers slip through the window?
Not how I would put it. May I promise you one more thing? When Seattle is destroyed, my war ends. I will retire, disappear, live quietly somewhere. Pacific Command may fight on or hang itself.
Valentine bowed his head.
You've been polite with me, so I won't tell you where you can stick your offer.
Now it's my turn to feel sorry for you. As to my offer, I doubt it would fit. My staff calls me all sorts of colorful names having to do with anal retentiveness.
They stared at each other. Valentine broke first.
So we're both too phlegmatic to get angry. Just out of curiosity, what's with the heroism stuff? I missed the chance at a lecture.
The action groups can't get everywhere. We regularly send propaganda deep into Seattle, along with certain painless, lethal pills, encouraging the populace to do the right thing. I understand you even flew some to a very difficult-to-reach area. With luck, many of them will be used. Their names will be added to the hero lists and read out in our broadcasts. I still have a friend or two west of here. But my time is nearly up. I should have liked to bring you to another new moon party at the Outlook. I believe you attended one before.
I kept to my room.
I'm sorry we didn't meet there. Better circumstances might have made our association a happier one. Farewell, David Valentine. Your theory about the inviolability of one soul is about to be tested.
Collection vans. Valentine had seen all varieties of them over the months and years of his trips through the Kurian zones. He'd seen buses with shuttered windows in Chicago, and long yokes for captives to be linked together in Hispaniola. He'd averted his eyes from vans in Wisconsin and armored cars in Louisiana. The principle was always the same. Whether they rode on battered old suspensions across snow-dusted old interstates in the Dakotas, or were pulled by a team of cart horses along an Alabama backwoods path. Separate those to be taken from the Reapers from the rest of society. Like so much of the Kurian Order, it was a simple mix of deception from the New Order and willful blindness in their subjects. Hide the contents of the stock trucks bound for the slaughterhouse, and allow those who might be unlucky enough to see one in operation the comfort of telling themselves a lie. Valentine had seen more of them than he cared to remember. But that chill November night was the first time he'd been put in the back of one. They made the switch at midnight on a small battered bridge over a river. Three bears in spiffy uniforms the color of a typical overcast pulled Valentine out of a concrete bunker and chained him to two other unfortunates, a man in the lead and a woman just in front of him. The man wore thick flannel and was barefoot. The woman stood shivering in militia pants and a t-shirt. Valentine passed a note to the bear in charge, a brief farewell to Guide he'd been allowed to pencil, thanking her for their weekend at the Outlook, and asking him to pass his regrets to Colonel LaHave and Captain Moffrey. Passing the note was made a little more difficult by the thick leather belt around his waist and the attachment for the handcuffs around his wrist. The bears brought him to the east end of the bridge. Valentine's night-sharp eyes saw a similar party on the other side. A flashlight waved up and down. One of the bears waved his horizontally right and left.
Let's go, dead man.
And women.
The man in front sort of lurched forward.
Move it.
My legs. I can't move my legs.
You just gotta walk to the other side of the bridge. Nothing's gonna happen to you there, not with that guy's around.
The man wouldn't move.
I will. I can't.
Oh, balls.
The bear and another each took an arm and they lifted him. As they carried him, he sputtered something about being really, honestly sorry. Why wouldn't anyone believe him that he was sorry? At the midpoint of the bridge, two prisoners were waiting, one in a blood-stained militia uniform. The other looked like a truck driver, thanks to his ball cap with Rolling Cooperative emblazoned on it. Quislings and bears exchanged sets of keys. Valentine noticed that the harnesses were identical. While this was going on, a bottle moved west, a thick roll of newsprint east. A bear chided his mate.
You shouldn't be doing that, Bongo.
I like to read their funnies. Don't read nothing else.
Don't or can't.
Shut down, you.
The exchange done, the bears accepted the two and immediately unlocked them. One of the bears threw the harnesses across his shoulder, presumably for the next midnight exchange. Valentine listened to the two bears who'd carried the lead man talk quietly as they walked away.
The one in the back, ain't he a bear?
I think so. Seen him in the uniform before Drizzle, anyway.
Do they know that?
Like I care.
Is it just me, or does this side of the river stink?
The man at the front, who had perhaps feared a glowering reaper at the other end of the bridge rather than a group of quislings, was able to walk the rest of the way. Valentine suspected he had shit himself as he was shaking something out of his trouser.
Don't feel too bad. Those fellas back there do it all the time when they fight.
Yeah, takes a lot of guts to gun down women and kids.
They were loaded into an old brown delivery van. Much of the front paneling was missing or cut away, along with the skirting. Whether this was for easier maintenance or security precaution, Valentine couldn't tell, though he knew collection vans were frequently wired with explosives. Duvalier had said something or other along those lines when they saw one in Kansas. The Quislings rolled the door shut and locked it, leaving them in darkness. Valentine heard the engine start, half hoped for an explosion. This was it. The last ride. Valentine was a little surprised at how calm he was. It was over. No more worries, cares, regrets about Malia and Amelie. What would Blake turn into? A fallible human capable of empathy? Or a cruel, instinct-driven automaton? He'd had a good run. Duvalier always said cats never lasted. He'd done more damage than most. If every human piled into a van could just take one enemy to the grave. The blank nothingness yawned before him, a forever of oblivion, the world spinning along, and he'd exist as a memory or a story of one of his many signed reports buried in some archive. He hoped his legs wouldn't fail him at the last. Maybe he could stamp on the Reaper's instep. Or would his bowels give way? The militia woman pressed up against Valentine.
Hey, buddy. Can you work your fly?
Pardon?
Let's do it. Right now. I can slip out of these pants.
You're kidding, right?
Come on, hurry.
No. Thanks, but no.
The van picked up speed, lurched into a higher gear. She slid over next to the other man. Valentine tried not to listen as he took her up on the same offer. Valentine smelled her sweaty sex in the confines. Valentine felt her foot touch his.
Hey, offer's still open if you want to turn.
He moved his foot away.
Hey, let me enjoy a moment, huh?
They exchanged names in the darkness. He was Colin, she Mona. 15 minutes later, they arrived. The van idled, and Valentine heard voices outside.
I'll confirm with Pound. 3 going in, right?
3, assuming we don't have another fucking suicide. They're trade goods, but you never know.
Wish I had one of those hero pills.
A bright light blasted into the back of the collection van, giving Valentine one of those instant diamond-shard headaches a sudden stimulus up his optic nerves seemed to cause. Valentine looked down, saw a name scratched on the wooden seat between his legs. Bob Barquist, Feb 15, '68. Valentine tried to remember where he'd been when Barquist was taking his ride. Probably back in the Ozarks with Anka, showing a group of leaders from the production resource how to grow heartroot in cold weather, to be eaten or ground up into pig and chicken feed. He wished there was some way he could have sent one more message to Narcisse, some bit of rhyme to teach Blake, or Malia, Allie even. Would she sigh and say that he hadn't been careful enough? He felt hands hauling him out of the collection van, and they turned the spotlight off.
I might be pregnant!
Mona was showing evidence that Valentine could only guess at as she pulled up her pants.
You need to take me to a medical center! I might be pregnant!
They stood at a brick wall. The collection van was parked at a gate. Old metal letters on a clear stretch of wall read, El Vieux Botanical Gardens. Someone had added an H before the ELL. The gap in the wall, big enough for 2 buses to pass, was closed by a yellow line of police tape. Inside, Valentine saw some old, overgrown buildings. The park looked to be in ruins, but he could still make out old lots and paths.
You guys got lucky.
He had flaps on his hat to keep his ears warm and a short beard.
Only 3 is. Pound of flesh always lets one make it out the other end alive. The way I see it is you've all got a 1 in 3 chance. Don't clobber each other right off the bat or we'll give you a dose of birdshot. And then you'll never make it up the other end of the long trail.
I want to see a doctor!
The Quisling in the hunting hat ignored her.
We'll use you all because you got that good old mountain crossing spirit. All you gotta do is get to where them lights are. See it? Way over there?
He pointed between 2 stands of trees. Valentine saw a pair of red lights on twin poles, like the goalpost on a football field, glowering eyes staring at them across the lush plant life. If they were in fact goalposts, they were a good half mile away, maybe 3/4 of a mile.
Strip.
Soldiers stepped forward, released their hands so they could pull their shirts off. Valentine felt his skin retreat at the cold night air.
Please! I could be pregnant! You never do this when someone is pregnant!
Shut up, you idiot!
There's a Reaper in there.
Good guess.
Valentine didn't guess. He knew.
Look at the weird burns on the back of this one. What did they do to you?
3 Quislings were fiddling with their harnesses while others covered them from an economy hatchback with a machine gun mounted on the hood.
Why can't I see a doctor?
Again, don't beat on each other. When the tape falls, you're off to the races.
No fair, they got shoes.
No fair, they've got shoes.
Get the rest of your stuff off. Shoes too.
They complied. What else could they do? Valentine put his arm around Mona, shared body warmth.
I hear it's not so bad.
They hypnotize you like a snake does a bird.
Ah!
The tape fell, and Valentine felt a sharp blow to the side of his knee. Colin had lashed out, and even now was running, the tape whipping free of his thighs as he headed across the overgrown parking lot. Valentine felt a shove in the back, and he and Mona sprawled on the other side of the wall. Valentine came up to a crouch. The Quislings began to close the gate.
I might be pregnant! You don't want to lose the baby!
Mona clung to the bars. She jackknifed. A rifle butt had come through and struck her in the stomach. Valentine helped her to her feet.
Let's go.
He looked back at the wall. A pair of heads watched him from the other side. Valentine picked up a rock and sent it whizzing at the heads, but missed.
Your buddy's already a quarter of the way to them lights!
Valentine pulled Mona down the path. It opened on what he guessed was another parking lot. The grasses and brush had been cleared here, and Valentine saw buildings on the other side.
Oh my God.
Four figures in a line greeted them, like odd plasticized mannequins with their skin removed, feet fixed in concrete. Elaborate layers of muscle made their faces a hideous salmon-colored patchwork. Valentine stepped up to one, realized it was a real corpse, covered in some kind of thick, clear plastic. The first one pointed, Uncle Sam style. "Don't be choosy," read a sign cradled in his arm. The next one was scratching her head. Her sign was on a sandwich board. "Pick away." "Guess wrongly," said the third, its hands on its hips like an exasperated parent. The fourth pointed to a little empty cement platform next to the others. "Right here, you'll stay." The parking lot trailed away to a path to the left. In the middle were the buildings, and to the right was another path heading at a 90-degree angle away from the twin lights, paralleling the wall. The left path, or the buildings, both led more directly to the goalposts. The buildings would be the most dangerous, but there might be something he could use as a weapon there. Valentine tried to sense the Reaper, or Reapers, but he was cold and his knee hurt, and Mona was pulling him back toward the gate.
I don't like this game. I'm gonna throw rocks at them till they shoot me.
Come on.
Valentine pulled her toward the buildings.
Let go, you bastard!
She fell to her knees.
You're just bringing me so you could throw me into its arms when you see it so you could get away!
Suit yourself.
Valentine let her go. She ran back to the gate. He smelled the air, searched the buildings with his ears. Valentine passed wide around a boarded-up building facing the parking lot and into a courtyard. Doors were welded shut or barred with heavy padlocks. Other closed-off buildings, one marked cafe, surrounded what had once been a nice little garden. Somewhere or other, Valentine had heard the phrase, bone garden. If there was such a thing in reality, rather than a metaphor for a cemetery, this was it. The wind chimes Valentine heard rattling were human skulls, hollowed out with tibias suspended within to add to the rattle. Wheels within wheels of plasticized human hands, some holding fans, others carefully cupped to catch the air, spun in the November breeze. Skeletons sat on benches admiring winter dead flowers. At least here the gardens showed some signs of being maintained. Around a table outside the cafe, four skeletons held forks and spoons over fresh, reeking piles of entrails. Valentine wondered what effect the Currians were trying to achieve. He'd heard auras could be flavored by the emotional state of the victim. Prolonged terror might add some kind of seasoning to the psychic palate. A skeleton stood in the classic Hamlet pose, wearing puffy breeches and a nailed-on feathered cap, holding a fresh-looking human head. It certainly stank like a three-day-old remnant. Hamlet didn't have his sword, but he had a femur. The tattooed cat who taught Valentine some basics of hand-to-hand combat always made Valentine recite the first rule of unarmed combat: arm yourself, or in this case, leg yourself. He wrenched the leg loose, spun and spun and spun it on its wire until the link weakened, then pulled it free. He went to one of the cement benches and broke it off at the knee end, giving himself a sharpened spike. Several paths led off the courtyard and the buildings. Valentine chose one of the paths through the trees. He passed through a vaguely oriental garden, at least judging from the architecture. The plants had mostly run wild, but there was still a bubbling, attractive-looking fountain. The water smelled clean. He reached forward. A fortunate foreshortened step saved him. He felt something brush his leg hairs, froze, looked down, saw a length of fishing line passing in front of the fountain. Valentine followed the wire to the trigger, then up to the overhanging trees, and saw a big latticework like a spiky fly swatter ready to fall and cripple a hand dipped in the water. It looked flimsy. Obviously, it wasn't designed to kill, just to injure and cause pain. Valentine stepped carefully onto the wooded path, every nerve alert. He willed his eyes into picking up every twig, every branch, every trap that might or might not be along the path. There'd once been a sign, probably an explanatory map, at the beginning of the tree-flanked path. Now a human skin, face and hair still attached, was stretched between the posts. The helpful tattooed warning read, "Don't run, you'll just die tired." The crotches of the trees held human skulls with glowing eyes. Valentine glanced at one as he passed. The eyes were golf balls painted with luminous paint. Valentine decided to parallel the path after he found a shallow pit filled with sharpened wooden spikes, smelling of fresh blood. Poor Colin. Reaper. Valentine crouched, tried to lower his life sign, tried to box up the cold and his sore knee. He gripped the splintered femur in both hands, the left steadying it, his right on the ball joint, ready to drive it. He saw Colin running wildly down the path, feet muddy, favoring one leg, but fear driving him through the pain. A cloaked reaper, its face white-painted, with eyes and lips blackened to imitate a skull, thin chest similarly decorated to enhance the ribs, skipped along behind him, raising first one long arm and then the other in a sort of dance. It sang as it hopped. Could he catch it unaware? The Reaper halted, pointed a long black-nailed finger at Valentine.
You wait your turn. Chimpy's first.
Colin sprawled, tripping on the same hole that had injured him earlier.
Oh, you've tripped. Get up. You're not finished yet. Run, 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 little silly man.
They disappeared toward the buildings, the Reaper harrying its prey like a dog driving a lone sheep. Valentine angled toward the western wall. 12 feet of brick, with trees well cut back, was topped with electrified fence.
Don't even think about it.
A megaphoned voice came from the trees. Valentine searched the timber, saw a hunting blind.
He's busy with the others. If you hurry, you'll make the finish line easy.
Valentine trotted back into the woods. He ran faster as he saw two red lights, broke out of the trees and up a long meadowed path, thick with night dew. Valentine saw more lines of fencing, angling toward the finish line. A couple of New Universal Church robed types stood before a candle-lit table with food and bottles and a trophy cup. But there was a cold piece of evil lurking just on the other side of the victory tape. Valentine sensed a Reaper under the table, alive and pulsing. A final shock for the winner? He couldn't say why that one little detail bothered him more than the nests of sharpened punji sticks on the path, or the humiliation of being stripped in front of joking guards. He turned and trotted back along the path toward the buildings. He found the others on the other side of a little wall-less Japanese building between two gardens filled with stones. The Reaper loomed behind Colin, poking him in the kidneys with a long black fingernail, urging him toward a crying Mona, holding out one hand as a plea to stop and covering her sex with the other. Valentine could hear the breathy, high-pitched voice.
1, 2, 3, 4, I declare a food war. 5, 6, 7, 8, the winner gets to make the gate.
The Reaper jumped and landed next to Mona, who tripped and fell.
You can take him. He's out of breath, wounded in the foot. Go for his other leg.
Colin jumped on her, got his fingers around her throat.
Now, Reaper, spread her legs inside, and I'll let you live.
It hung over the couple, its cloak drawing a curtain around them. Valentine flitted between trees, put the cement of the little pagoda between himself and the scene.
No! No, please! Oh, God!
Something at the base of his spine woke up and twitched. It ran hot up his back, perched between brain and skull atop his head like a spider. Valentine hopped up on top of the pagoda and made the jump with the thoughtless ease of a house cat leaping to a kitchen table. Dirt and clinging plants fell, displaced by his weight, but before they hit the ground, he was a gargoyle shape half hanging from the pagoda roof. Below, the Reaper opened its jaw and shot its tongue toward Colin's back, teeth following. The greenery hit the ground next to the Reaper. It turned its head, eyes following the trajectory up, and met Valentine on the way down. He landed atop the Reaper, driving the femur down toward the great beehive-like organ that sucked down the blood. It reached up, backward hinging arms moving for him, but Valentine was off it, moving on white-hot instinct, hardly knowing what his body was going to do next. He swung a stiff-fingered uppercut, felt fingers break through skin, grabbed the Reaper under its hyper-extended jaw, fingers closing on bone, dragged it off Colin, who had a gaping tongue-sized wound in his back. Valentine whipsawed, and the Reaper sprawled. He held its white-painted jaw in his hands. The Reaper rose, confusion in its eyes as its tongue lolled. Valentine cast the jawbone aside and readied his femur for another strike. The Reaper turned and ran. Valentine was after it, a wild predator drawn by flight. He got on its back and drove the sharpened femur up through the gap left by the jaw. Mona pressed her hands against the wound in Colin's back. Blood came up under her fingers anyway. Another Reaper came running from the woodland path in the direction of the goalposts, its feet a blur, a strange, oversized, leering jack-o'-lantern mask atop its head. Valentine picked himself up, left the twitching, dying, genetically engineered corpse, and ran toward the new one, ink-smeared bone in his hands. The Reaper slowed, perhaps not used to a man running toward it. Valentine's heart seemed to fill his entire chest cavity, its throb rattling his ribs and collarbones. Some sane corner of his mind hammered out thoughts as fast as letters flew from a quick typist.
You don't know how to fight, great thirsty slug. You've forgotten how. Send all the puppets you want. You can no more fight than fuck. Time to face me. Product of a warrior race bred and tested in 10,000 years battle. Scarier than any costume. Don't run, you'll just die tired.
The Reaper turned and ran. Its mask slipped, and it blindly plowed into a tree, lurched onward, tearing the mask free to run. Valentine angled through the trees and caught up to it just outside the glowing eyes of the goalposts. It turned at the last second, threw up its arms to ward him off, and Valentine caught it at the knees with a diving tackle, knocking it down, felt claws open wounds in his shoulders as he drove his femur up between its legs. The Reaper didn't have sexual organs, but its skeleton had a gap.
Kill it so they send me another, and another. No.
Valentine fought to form words.
You.
He straddled the Reaper, feeling stronger than he had ever felt in his life. He twisted the femur.
You, at the other end, talk, or I make your puppet into a corn dog.
Stop! Please!
Valentine withdrew the femur, and the Reaper lashed out with its free arm. He caught it at the wrist and twisted it until he heard a snap.
Stop it!
It was like talking in a foreign tongue. He had to force himself to make words.
I'll take your toy apart a limb at a time, then I'll hang your churchmen from the goalposts.
What do you want? I give you your life. I give the female her life. I give the man his life. Just let my servants go.
Are you Seattle? The head honcho?
No.
I want to talk to your chief, king, grand and exalted overlord, whatever he calls himself, the one in the big tower.
He does not deal with your kind directly.
Then through you, I don't care. Tell him I have an offer.
What could a human give such as he?
Adler, the leader of the resistance.
The Reaper's slit eyes widened.
Impossible.
Valentine reached up, got his hand around its windpipe, felt the thick muscles that drove the tongue. Valentine released his grip.
Yes, yes, cease sense. You shall have your meeting with his representative among the mortal.
Mouthpieces. Every Kurian organization depends on layers of intermediaries between the Kurian lords and their human herds. Seattle is no different. All the layers of police, troops, secret police, church investigators, even diplomats to other Kurian zones report to one man's office in Seattle, and that man is Maximum Silas. Impressive looking, with a good eye for clothes, and an even more impressive speaker and judge of character, he's something of a born second in command. Some in the know of the ins and outs of Seattle's realm believe him to be more important than the lesser Kurian lords in the feudal conglomeration, especially with recent desertions of the Kurians supposedly guarding the borders of Seattle's empire. He has his faults, of course. If an original thought ever entered his head, it got lonely and left. He's also a man who lives very much in the present day. Maximum Silas watches over his city from the old Space Needle, overshadowed by the greater Kurian Spire, doubling the highest heights of the Seattle skyline, as if contesting Mount Rainier itself. Why he chose the Space Needle as a location for the meetings of his highest military, industrial, and church leaders might be answered better by psychology than logistics or practicality. Silas receives credit for his division of the city into neighborhood-sized quads, each ruled by a Kurian. School and work and sports teams encourage quad loyalty. These in turn are gathered into conferences where a presiding Kurian clan works out squabbles. In theory, a human need never leave his conference. The whole of his existence is encompassed in the square miles that make up a conference, though he will sometimes travel to another conference to root for a home team in a championship or listen to a political speech. It is this simple system that allowed Seattle to expand his realm in the 2050s, owning all the land between the Grogs in Oregon and the thinly inhabited coastline north of Vancouver. From the Kurian point of view, the apparently powerless quad role was attractive, for the number of human auras he had to pass up the food chain was strictly limited, and in return he received the military protection of Quisling formations organized at the conference level. Seattle can be credited with being the only Kurian overlord who regularly saw his fellow Kurians petition him to be included in his empire. Until, of course, the advent of Adler and his brutal strategy. Adler would strike in secret, hard and fast, at the quad level of the Kurian Order, harassing and chipping at the vulnerable fringe of Seattle's realm. He avoided every trap laid for him, seeming to know which quads were strongly garrisoned and which were weak. Silas had few ideas of how to cope with the crisis. His expertise in security was limited to quelling dissent from within and breaking up organizations like the Resistance Network. But Seattle himself is not without the canniness of a hunted fox. He sent to his sub-realm of Vancouver for the big-mouth amphibian grogs and used the numerous waterways around Seattle to gird his realm, though a good deal of his productive capacity is now spent feeding grogs rather than trading with other Kurian zones for the goods that once made Seattle such a pleasant place to live and breed. Five great shafts, laid out like the dots on the five of an ordinary craps die, rose straight up in shafts of blue-green like a fountain frozen in time. The Kurian compartments, as Valentine thought of them, began above the tallest of the city's buildings. They looked like mollusks or barnacles clinging to a pier, rather than the spider egg sac orbs he'd seen in the middle of the country. Atop all, like a great mushroom cap, was the dome of Seattle himself. Valentine watched the city of Seattle through the outward slanting windows of the Space Needle. He tried to imagine what the roads looked like long ago, filled with cars and trucks, the crushed remains of which now formed barriers between Seattle's zones. Now there were just bicyclists and a few motor scooters, making way for smoke-belching army trucks, biofuel buses, and the occasional gleaming SUV. He'd first relayed the bare bones of a plan to a pair of skeptical military adjutants, but as he spoke, they'd grown more and more interested. Then he spent a day in an apartment on what he guessed was a military base. Later, they told him that he'd need to speak to Chief Executive Silas's Regional Security Work Group. So they gave him soap and a razor, sent a girl in to trim his hair and nails, and gave him an afternoon to present his plan. Valentine had wandered to the observation rail while the Quisling leadership ate. A sharp lemony smell filled his nostrils, and Valentine heard a heavy shuffling step. He turned. A squared-off man, all right angles and pinstripes, stood on the observation platform looking at him. He had golden rings on each hand. Behind him was a big gray grog, who evidently was the source of the lemony smell. Valentine couldn't remember ever seeing one of the long-armed greys so neatly trimmed and coiffed. It wore a kilt with sewn-in scabbards for weapons, and the butts of two rifles projected from its shoulders. Silver-capped teeth shone against lips greasy with roast beef juice, its tongue discreetly probing for trapped morsels.
I take it you're Valentine.
The man stepped up with hand out. He was about Valentine's height, but built a little heavier.
I'm Silas, chief executive around here. Kerr, commend you.
David Valentine. You could get a fair price out of the Louisiana Currians for me, by the way.
The grog hovered as Valentine shook hands.
You're not frightened of grogs, are you? Silvers is well-trained.
Ukus.
Valentine lowered his left hand toward the floor and brought the right to the center of his chest. The greeting was a fairly universal one in St. Louis, but he didn't know if it applied out here. The grog slapped his own center line a few times.
Introductions being over, we've got another hour or so of work after lunch. Sorry to keep you waiting, but we're running late. Then it's going to be all military, and you're first on the agenda. Seattle himself is curious as to what you're going to propose, you know. It would be in your own interest not to disappoint him. If I understand, you're some kind of assassin. You took the measure of two Reapers, unless I'm being misinformed.
It was me or them. I'm glad Seattle is the forgiving type.
Nobody much likes the Bellevue clan. They trade with the insurgents, and word gets around about that little exercise field. Unsettles the herd.
You're one of the herd yourself, aren't you?
One body can always be swapped with another. But talent, that's not so easily discarded. Do you know what these are?
He held out his manicured hands, an NUC-crested brass ring on the left, a plainer one on his right.
Brass rings.
Yes. Word of advice, Valentine, don't believe your own propaganda posters about freedom and all that. There's always been the rulers and the ruled.
He tapped the glass in the direction of the city.
The Currians aren't that different from other rulers throughout history, save for one twist. They do want productive births and productive lives, just like all the others. The only thing all this slanging is about is their desire for, when the time comes, productive deaths. Reuse and recycling of strange and mysterious energies otherwise lost to the cosmos.
If that's what you believe, then I hope I'm around when you go drowsy and forgetful. You gonna strip off those rings and volunteer for recycling?
I've earned a ripe old age, and I intend for it to be a productive one. Sadly, I've not had time for children yet. Our aphrodisiacs have been certified for 90-year-olds, but really, I didn't come here to talk about myself or the honorable family name. I wanted to get an idea about you before plunging into all the hows and whens. I'm a little curious about what you want out of all this.
Put in your words. I want to stop the unproductive deaths. Adler is slaughtering whole families.
Both sides are exhausted from all the fighting. The Currians never thought it would take so long to reorganize us. Every new eruption kills more in a few weeks than the Currians do in a year. It's waste. Sheer waste.
An elegant woman in business dress, lovely eyes behind thick glasses, cleared her throat from the hallway.
Mr. Silas, they are reassembled and await you.
Silvers took a long snootful of the air around the assistant and popped his lips together. Dop, dop, dop.
I look forward to hearing your plans, Valentine. I just don't think you can organize another mutiny here. We're not stupid.
Never said you were, Silas. Rotten, maybe, but not stupid.
You're not my idea of an ally, either.
We don't need to respect each other as long as we cooperate. I'd make a deal with the devil himself to stop Adler's slaughter.
2.5 hours later, Valentine finally got a chance to talk in the meeting room at the top level of the Space Needle. It rotated with the speed of a minute hand, slowly shifting from city skyline to mountains to the bay. He stood at one end of a long, slightly curved wooden table, richly lacquered and the color of blood. Papers placed on it seemed to hover above their own shadows. The table could hold 22 at a pinch, Valentine guessed, but at the moment only 4 figures sat at it, Silas at the other end. Lesser operatives sat discreetly at the edges of the room, near phones and computer terminals, but Silas dismissed them for the day, keeping only those seated at the table and his secretary. And, of course, Silvers, filling a battered sofa just behind Silas's chair.
What the hell is a deep amphibious operation?
The speaker was a general with heavy, burnished steel shoulder boards. He had the fleshy look of a man who liked to do his generaling after a late breakfast and before cocktail hour.
Hear him out!
He was chided by a uniformed woman with a raccoon mask of camouflage airbrushed across her eyes. Her bristle-short haircut made one of Alessa Duvalier's self-administered razor jobs look vulpine.
About time someone talked about going on the offensive. We need more men willing to put their balls on the table. Pardon the expression.
Keep yours behind your zipper, Park.
Let the man answer the question.
The table went silent again. Behind him, the city's skyline glowed in splashes of color, searchlights illuminating the old, empty office buildings as though they were national monuments. Lights dusted the edges of the city and washed down the road.
I just made up the term, but it describes what I think your big mouths can accomplish, if the field training I received about their habits was correct. I read some news bulletins about their use in Florida deep into the Everglades.
How many will you need?
The question came from a man wearing thick black wool. He had the fishy odor of a man off a long day at a gutting wharf. Valentine couldn't tell if he was in casual military clothes or civilian wear so rugged and severe it could pass for a uniform. His name tag was similar to the general's and that of the woman called Park, a black rectangle with white lettering. His read Troyd.
Well, I have to see them training to decide that. Do you train them?
We do.
He kept his hands out of sight under the table, unlike the others, who were making notes or drinking coffee or tea.
How are you going to get past the river barriers?
I know a little about the watch system. Before my comrades delivered me into your little garden of horrors, I was an officer in the troops that supplied the river sentries. Dangerous work.
That's why they had Peebies doing it, no?
Yes. I even lost a few men to them in the fall. We never found the bodies.
They've adjusted their fertility cycle to the salmon runs. Whoever eats the most gets to be female and host the fry. Sometimes they even eat the males. The males don't swim away quick enough after the mate.
Oh, that's a fucked up way to do it.
Troy shrugged.
Make for a quieter world.
Let's set comparative biology aside for now. We've learned what you'll need for the job. What do you want in return?
Some peace and quiet. Nice little house, maybe on one of those islands outside of the bay there. A nice boat, not quite a yacht, but something I can use for travel or fishing. A few servants and a couple women to keep me warm on those clammy nights. But most important, one of those brass rings like you all wear, so I get left alone.
You settle with us?
Not with you. Among you. I'm not going to be welcome back with Pacific Command. I'm under a hanging judgment with Southern Command.
Brass rings aren't mine to give out. Speaking of which, there's going to be one awarded to our friend Troyd here at the next audience for his work with the Big Mouths.
And well deserved.
Damn, is that this week?
The general was looking down at his organizer book.
I may have to beg off. I've got inspections in Tacoma.
Silas kept his gaze on Valentine.
Oh, it's a boring ceremony. Speeches mostly. Gives the TV station something to broadcast for a few weeks. I might arrange for a short interview. Seattle is most interested in the proposition, and he would be the one to promise a ring.
I'm not doing it on faith.
We're not so sure you can do it.
I wouldn't expect a ring to be handed out unless I accomplish the mission.
I'm expected at a wedding banquet for one of my colonels. Can we wrap this up?
Silas nodded to his breathtaking secretary.
I'll call for a vote on the Valentine proposition, and we'll adjourn.
He touched a button on the arm of his chair.
Captain Chu, take Valentine back to the lounge.
Suppose you vote the proposal down.
You might end up in Seattle's tower anyway, but in considerably less distinction. But don't worry. A part of you will live on as a conversation piece.
Valentine went back to the lounge, smelled the nervousness on Captain Chu. Valentine wondered if the man expected to be stabbed with a stir stick. He felt too tired, too disgusted with himself to put up much of a fight, even if the vote went against him. 10 minutes later, the door opened, and he saw the French cuffs of Silas, a broad smile on his face. But he had Silvers with him rather than the statuesque secretary. Valentine struggled to look nonchalant.
The vote ended up unanimous in your favor.
All four? I figured that general was hedging.
Three. Friend Troyd sat at the table as a courtesy, but he doesn't have his ring just yet. I decided to seat the minimum for an official meeting of the security staff. I imagine the less who know about your project, the better.
Wise of you.
I want you to have dinner with me tonight. We'll get you cleaned up and into some decent clothes. When you're out mixing with the other ranks, your cover story is that you're an emissary from Catalina, learning how to handle big mouths. You know anything about Catalina?
Not really. Island off the California coast is about all.
Don't worry. No one here's ever been there. Our only contact with them is for oil transactions, and the energy staff isn't scheduled to renegotiate for 18 more months. Just pretend you're wealthy. Oh, and say awoha now and again.
Valentine rode back to the city in Silas's limousine with his secretary. The trunk of the vehicle had been heavily modified to accommodate Silvers in his own semi-cupola, complete with the first grog gun Valentine had seen since leaving St. Louis. This one was a piece of craftsmanship, twin barrels, each with its own two-thick magazine sloping down at an angle with a built-in firing shield. Silvers strapped himself into the gun and the seat like the deep-sea fisherman Valentine had seen in the Caribbean.
It's quite a hog leg your bodyguard totes.
Valentine was looking through the tiny back window at Silver's hair whipping in the wind.
That little apparatus came off an armored personnel carrier initially. I think they're,
25 millimeter. Thunder City Rangeworks.
Yeah, well, anyway, they cost a lot. I'm sorry, David Valentine, Ludi Louche. She usually goes by Miss L. Top quality English import, and almost as hard to get as a Rolls.
I'll save you some time. Luby Bush, Lusty Tush, Lucy Flush, Thirsty Lush, and combinations thereof.
Valentine felt like a drawling backcountry scrub compared with these elegant-sounding creatures.
She was ill-bred enough to make herself so useful I had to keep her around, even after we got tired of each other.
They took an off-ramp into the city, passed through a gate in a concrete wall, and pulled up beneath a well-lit turnaround, sheltered by a gold-fringed awning, protecting a carpeted path to shining brass and glass doors.
This is my pied-à-terre in the city. Let's get you changed for the better, and then talk more over dinner.
Whatever Silas says.
I've heard that one before, too.
They rode up in an elevator that made the one in Fran Paoli's building in Xanadu seem like a freight. A little screen in the elevator showed the time, date, and outside temperature as it ticked off names and what Valentine guessed were locations every few seconds. Neither of the others paid any attention to the screen, so Valentine ignored it as well. The elevator opened into what Valentine guessed to be Silas's apartment. It was airy and open, a prairie school foyer-living room combination filling two floors. Stairs passed up on either side to doors that Valentine guessed to be bedrooms, and glass filled the wall facing the bay. A patio filled with plants had a second floor to the left side.
I like a drink after that many circuits in the needle. You like scotch, Valentine?
You're a brave man, Silas.
Why is that?
Well, you left your bodyguard downstairs. I'm a desperate insurgent. Suppose I went for your throat.
Miss L removed her jacket. Valentine saw a soft leather holster strapped under her arm, the shining butt of an automatic inside.
It's loaded with hollow points.
Have to admire a woman who brings her own protection.
I believe in redundancy. Speaking of which, Ludi, see if you can find friend Valentine one of my suits, from when I'm better about exercising and down 10 pounds.
She led Valentine up the carpeted stairs into a bedroom that had been converted into an oversized closet, complete with three-way mirror. She walked down the line of jackets.
I'd like to see you in gray flannel. You're too serious for double-breasted. A vest will make you look like a pimp with that hair. We'll stick to a simple cotton shirt. Where are you from again?
Minnesota.
That's the one east of Wisconsin?
West of Wisconsin.
Ah.
She paused until he looked at her.
How old is your mother?
I'm sorry?
Just wondering if she was old regime or not.
No, she died fairly young.
I'm truly sorry to hear that. Here, try these. I'll give you some privacy. There's clean socks and underwear in the drawers. I'm sure Mr. Silas won't mind you taking a pair.
They ate off china in a restaurant with a French name filled with blue velvet and gold trim. Miss L went home for the evening, and Silvers took his spot at his master's shoulder. The grog got his own bench behind a thin curtain and sucked down an entire tureen of soup, softly hooting to himself as the men ate. Valentine had salmon with dill and assorted greens, Silas king crab legs. Silas probed him, not about opinions of the Currians and those who worked for them, but about music and art and books he'd read. Over dessert, they talked about what kind of sports Valentine enjoyed. Silas apologized for the size of the desserts, enormous slabs of cheesecake slathered in syrupy strawberries.
If I have a weakness, it's for sweets.
Mind answering a question?
That's foolish to answer before hearing the question.
Why the VIP treatment?
You're not getting the VIP treatment. I am. You're just in the overkill.
And the questions about jazz versus jug band?
Just trying to take the measure of you.
I appreciate the clothes, but this isn't the life I want. I could never live in the shadow of one of those towers.
Silas laid down his delicate dessert fork.
Do you speak from experience?
I've spent years at a stretch in the Currian Zone.
There's no such thing as never. I'm pretty sure some mathematician or other proved that.
Silas put Valentine up in an almost empty apartment in his building, with some apologies that it would be temporary. But it did have a bed and hot water, and it was warm and dry. Valentine looked out at the city through two layers of glass door, both locked and welded shut. The next day, after a quick rundown on the public transit system from Miss L, they fitted him with a plastic-sheathed metal loop around his ankle. A twitchy technician issued him an ID card and swiped it through a slot in a black plastic circle the size of a wristwatch face embedded in the loop.
Okay, Valentine, comma D, of the Catalina Island and Baja Principalities. Your TRFID transmitter verifies who you are every time you use the card. Just in case you lose it, it's useless to anyone else.
He consulted a screen.
You'll be okay for travel downtown for a couple days. Wow, nice expense account.
It's not going to electrocute me in the shower or blow my foot off if I leave Seattle, will it?
The technician raised his eyes.
Catalina must really suck if they run it like a work camp.
No comment.
Nah, it won't do any of that. Go swimming with it.
He didn't swim, but he spent 2 days exploring Seattle, staying as far away from the Currian Tower as he could. It seemed a technology-driven city, and Valentine couldn't understand half of the conversations going on in the cafes. Every other block had a technical college or a medical school, mostly filled with foreign students from Asia. Everyone had an ankle tag, except for a few arty types who wore theirs around their necks, and it was from one of these that Valentine learned the coding system. Black indicated foreign dignitaries.
Course upper management has theirs implanted.
A youngish long hair cradled a leather-topped wooden drum in a relaxed lounge with the intriguing name Earworm Cafe.
Everyone's got to bear the mark of Almighty Babylon.
The young man was working on an old computerized music player with a portable light and a set of precision tools.
Says the dude who spends every other morning getting CI certification.
The girl shook her head as she cleaned a table and collected discarded mugs.
Double Duck, you'll be wiring IDs to your own family before you know it.
Go pop out another kid for the churchies, your royal no compromises.
You are so cruising.
She bared sharpened teeth, and Valentine decided to pay his bill. And the boys. Back at his apartment, he found a note.
Don't forget audience tomorrow. I had the suit pressed and the shirt cleaned. Lutie.
The next day, Valentine stood in borrowed clothes under a cheap plastic poncho. Seattle's mighty tower soared above him, making him feel like an ant in the shadow of a redwood. A vast plaza surrounded the tower, rimmed with decorative columns topped with pensive statues of reapers that served a more discreet purpose as vehicle barriers. Inside the circle, it was paved with red and gray bricks that probably formed some kind of design when seen from on high, perhaps a spiral of some kind. Valentine guessed that at least 4 square blocks of downtown Seattle had been knocked down to make the expanse. A strange sort of scaffolding had been set up in front of the tower. Perhaps 3 stories high on its own, it consisted of 2 staircases leading up to a long, bridge-like platform, an isosceles triangle aimed at the center column. A television camera was perched halfway up the stairs. The spectators gathered for the audience consisted of well-dressed functionaries in the front and a mass of shaggy student types farther back, each of whom received a little paper ticket like a theater admittance. The Seattle police, in waxy black leather jackets, herded the entire crowd into one narrow mass in front of the scaffolding. Silas went up to the television platform and spoke to the cameraman, who turned his camera out on the crowd. Silas looked through it as well, and the police had the crowd spread out a little at the back and passed out banners that could be unfurled to hide the lack of numbers. Seattle, City of Dreams and Progress, read one. Pacific Coast Best and Brightest Honors Kerr. Then there was the eternal, Our Future is Bright Again, in phony childish lettering, held up by the uniformed youth vanguard troops, which Valentine had seen in every political rally he'd attended in the Kurian Zone. Duvalier always said that youth vanguard troop rallies were so filled with high-ranking Quisling pederasts and pedophiles that the banner should read, Our Cherry is Plucked Again.
Why not just round up more people for the audience?
Valentine spoke with one of the cops.
That's what we do back home.
Well, that's what I tell them. Just give folks a day off so they can come into the plaza. Give them luxury coupons like they give those sweating kids. They want to have their cake and eat it too is all. Can't lose 10 lousy hours of work. What they do is give everyone a half day on Friday so they can go home and watch the speeches rebroadcast.
That many televisions around. You sure don't have that at home.
Shit, yeah. Back in the good times, before all the fighting with the insurgents, this was a sweet spot.
Sorry to hear that.
Getting so, even a police badge ain't proof against a call. Like I was...
A blast of music from the speakers mounted on the scaffolding interrupted him. Silas's limo pulled up to the scaffolding, and he and Troy got out. Silas, wearing an elegant camel hair coat that stood out against the dull aluminum of the metal, led Troy up the stairs. After a brief introduction as the skilled xenologist who is doing so much to reverse our recent misfortunes, Troyd walked up a set of railless stairs that seemed impossibly narrow to Valentine. It was tipped with a sort of pulpit, and from there, by leaning on the rail and reaching his hand up, Troyd could just reach a sort of blister on the side of the tower. Silas spoke, talking about battles recently won that Valentine had never heard of, except for a small skirmish that resulted in a raiding PB company retreating from an old state trooper station. To hear Silas describe it, another Stalingrad had been won. Troyd passed his hand through a shimmering wall of light and pulled it out, still dripping with what looked like liquid fire. He shook it off and held up his undamaged hand, and the new brass ring on his finger glimmered like Venus on a dark night. Valentine half listened to the speeches, marking the placement of reapers. Two stood at the bottom of each stairway. Troy descended the stairs more surely and stepped to the microphones. With the TV camera on him, he gave a brief halting speech, thanking Seattle for his generosity and leadership as a banner unfurled from the bottom of the scaffold. 29 rings awarded in our sixth decade. What's stopping you from getting yours? With Troy's speech concluded, the Archon stepped to the microphones again. He clutched the railing and sagged for a moment, but Silas helped support him. With that, he raised his head, and with his eyes rolling and cheeks twitching, he spoke.
My children, your Kurian friends and allies have this day placed one of your number among the eagles that soar over this lovely land of ours. He is an example to be followed, for he teaches us the virtue of cooperation and utility. The beings he directs to guard your homes may look fearsome to you, but consider how fearsome they must look to those who threaten our peace. Perhaps then you shall look on their strange faces and see beauty. We, your Kurian friends and allies, know you have sacrificed to feed these beings, but who regrets a toe when a leg is saved? There are dark forces at the gates of our city, so long a symbol of the heights mankind can reach, with just the tiniest touch of a friendly hand. With these fresh allies beside us, we can look to better days ahead. Belief in victory will lead to work for victory. Work for victory will lead to an affirmation of that belief. Too many homes have been darkened by death in the last year. New medicines are even now on their way to church dispensaries to help you dispel whatever fears and doubts you may have. But these have not come cheaply. We must bring the new B6 into production to meet orders already placed, and certain luxuries will, for a time, become unavailable. Your conferences will provide you with details of our plans to increase output. If we all push together, a very short period of sacrifice will put us back on the road to prosperity and peace. Meet these hardships not as a burden among burdens, but as a challenge above self. Will you, my family, accept this challenge?
Yes! 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 Yes!
Yes!
The youth vanguard jumped up and down with each yes.
Yes!
After a few close-ups of people cheering and a rowdy student or two lifting her sweater and t-shirt, the TV cameraman left. Silas came down the stairs, chatting with Troyd.
Wait for Valentine a moment, won't you, Troyd? I believe he's going to accompany you back to your wet little camp. Unless you want to come up and pay your respects in person?
Troyd looked at the ring on his hand, rubbed the skin.
No, I was touched once. That's enough for me.
Oh, then it's you and me, Valentine.
What? Up there?
Of course.
I thought I could just speak to one of the...
We call them avatars.
One of the avatars.
He wants to look at you with his own eyes. All 8 of them. Are you coming?
Valentine nodded and stepped up onto the scaffold stairs. The 4 Reapers came up the stairs with them. Valentine saw the TV man blanch as he placed his camera in a padded bag and frantically wound cables as the Reapers passed.